Thank you for, obviously, your patience and being able to understand. It's been months and months, twice a week. Daniel has been doing music, and he hasn't broken the string during it once yet. And there was once.
All right.
So, obviously, that's one of those, I did want to, I wrote them down, not because I don't know their names, because I don't want to forget anybody that's up here. I wanted to be able to introduce you. These are some of the students that we have with our high school ministry. So we got Tommy's been playing piano for us, and he just obviously has a little bit of talent in that regard. He plays beautifully. Thank you, Tom. Savannah has been. When did you start playing guitar?
Like almost a year ago, Jack.
Yeah, so she's been playing for about a year and is amazing. Sophia, wave. Sophia, Emma joined us this morning with vocals. You get to wave too, so they know which one. So, Emma, Isabella is on the box, which I don't know the right name for it, I always call it wrong. Yeah, percussion. So Isabella, and then Andrea is at the back, and Andrea got this beautiful bass for Christmas this year, which is wonderful. And of course, Daniel, who just continues to be a blessing with the student ministry as he works with both the junior high and the high school every week. And then up in the sound booth this week, we have Gabe. Callow's been doing the advancing the slides for us, so we've got students starting to be involved as we can. Huge blessing. And before they, actually some of them can go, and a few of them are going to come up here to this part, because I got some questions for them. Yes. I told them they were doing this. I'm not sure why they're. And Caitlin's coming up also. So I wanted them to just kind of share, obviously a weird, we keep saying this, but it's true, weird year with our pandemic. And I wanted you to hear from them kind of what this year has looked like and has looked like for them and kind of what the youth ministry then has meant for them. So you first, young lady. So basically, I'm going to hold it.
Okay.
What has been like the good and the bad of this year and or bad?
A lot of good. That's great. Because of COVID, I got to go to New York twice, which was great, except it was to see my family, so that's not that great. no offense to my family that's not here.
But
so
video, that's it's good. Yeah, for life.
Well,
sorry.
Good thing they live in New York and can talk smack about them. Not that I do. Wow, this is going downhill very fast. sorry, I'm sweaty.
So, what's anything bad?
A lot of good things. I got to play in this band. And bad, I mean, I don't have a social life, but to start, I didn't really have one. So, it's not that much of a loss.
But you've been... But
and a bad is... Yes.
What about the youth ministry?
Oh.
What has it kind of meant to you this year?
It's been great. I always used to think of the worship team as nerds. And now I'm one of those nerds. So, it's great.
Which means you learned they're not nerds.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, they are nerds. I'm not going to lie.
They're not nerds.
I mean, they are. It's true. But I really got to apply myself in the youth ministry. Now I plan out games for the middle schoolers, even though they make me not want to. And I got to join... Sorry. Wow, they're still... I'm failing at this.
You're doing good.
No,
you got more. Okay.
Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
It's just been great because I made a lot of friends and now I kind of have a social life, but they're all kind of losers. So.
What? Why do you?
But they're nice.
I talked. I like went through this before. She said none of this, and I'm not really sure. Nervous?
No.
Okay. You should.
Hi.
And Caitlin, freshman. Right? Okay.
Yeah.
So good and bad? Good and or bad?
The good is I'm being adopted by my stepdad.
Aw. Which is wonderful.
And my sister. Yeah.
Bad? Anything? There doesn't have to be. Like, I'm not forcing you to have bad things.
There have been bad things, but... Oh, I'm shaky.
It's okay.
It's been a really stressful year.
It has.
A lot of things have happened.
And then, was the youth ministry meant for you this year?
There's a lot of new people that I wouldn't have met.
A lot of new people?
Yeah. Like, a lot of them are homeschooled, and they're pretty cool, so.
So, nice.
Yeah.
Excellent. Thank you. And Andrea?
Something good. I get to play in the band, which I love music and love performing, so that was a good thing, and I get to see my friends here. Something bad that COVID's done is, because of COVID, me and my family were not able to have a funeral for my grandpa.
And youth ministry for you this year?
It's basically mean I get to, like, see my friends, and they get to play with the band, and I get to get out of the house.
Nice. Excellent. Okay, you girls can sit down. Thank you. So, what I love is that genuinely gives you a picture, just a snapshot of what kind of what kids are going through this year, from visiting family to not being able to be with family at certain times too. But then I think you hear some of that common thread of community that they're able to be involved with because we have been able to keep meeting. So we'll say a little more about that in a second. So we've been going through a series on David that Pastor has been leading us through, and we are going to take a break from that this week as we have this being a Youth Sunday. And I wanted to, instead of talking about David, although I could have maybe said, you know, David was 15 when he was anointed about, and then he was in his 22-ish when he fought Goliath, so it's like, that's kind of the teen years. That's about all that we're going to connect to David this morning. But we're in a culture that is like, it is rapidly changing. That's why I like them giving you just kind of a picture of these students' lives. But the culture, it's evolving, and it's changing so quickly. How can we keep up, basically? And how do we speak truth into a culture that is evolving so quickly and rapidly? I'm going to start, though, with a little game. Youth ministry, we play games in youth ministry, right? So I'm going to put some emojis up on the screen, and I want to see if you know not what you use it for, but what the actual proper name of what it is called, okay? Which is vastly different from what you're probably using it as. So the first one, okay, take a minute. You've seen this one, probably use it a lot. It's supposed to be the most used emoji is this one. Okay. Oh, what do you think? Laughter, mostly. It's actually called face with tears of joy. I know. Who knew, right? So that's that one. Then this next one. It's similar, but different. Face with sad streams? Okay, loudly crying face. So if you want to communicate that you are not only crying, but you're crying loudly, that's it. Now, this is one of those evolving kind of things. This is starting to become... Actually, sorry, we'll get there. Oh, hold on. This one, it's starting to be used for, like, not... The previous one was laughter. Now this one is laughter because you're laughing so much harder. So it's a more emphatic laughing, not actually sad at all. But now the next one. All right. And what do you think this one is? Cowboy. Cowboy hat face. I mean, it's kind of like, well, okay, yes it is, isn't it? And this one... I'm curious, does anybody use this one? I know, yeah. Shocking, I know, but I don't find myself using this one a lot. So according to, I'll say why in a second. Just I checked with our students about this because supposedly it's like if something's really awkward, you might use this. But the students that we have, I asked them, and not at all. They're like, that's if stuff's about to get real, real rowdy, like yee-haw, right? Like, woo! So that's you know, crazy. Okay, so according to an article, though, that's been making the rounds real recently, that first emoji that we showed, right, the one with the tears, that is no longer being used among the young people. The kids today, right, they're not using that one, unless it's ironic, right? Like, oh, look at me, I'm crying. Because you know who uses it? Their parents, right? And grandparents use it, so it's no longer cool for them to use. Now, to be honest, I checked with, like, our students, and they're like, no, I use that, like, 20 times a day for that. And I'm like, okay, good. So if you're like me, we're still okay to use that one. Things haven't progressed that far yet. But just be aware that might be coming ahead, that you might have to stop using that at some point, if you want to be cool, that is. Now, here's a couple other things, according to this article, that are moving out. Because apparently there's, like, this trend right now between millennials, which are no longer teenagers, if you weren't aware, but it's Gen Z is the new teens that are coming up, and there's kind of a debate between them about what is cool and not cool anymore. One of the things is skinny jeans, which, I mean, that makes sense, I suppose. But another one is side parts. Side parts are no longer, I'm sorry, which, I mean, come on. One of the girls fixes her hair. Move it over. So that one, you know, and I verified again, I checked with our students, and like, no, that's not a thing. So obviously when you read stuff, you got to check your source, because sometimes it's not right. But we do see culture moving rapidly all the time, right? That is something that we can say we do see. One of my daughters, in fact, the younger daughter, was making fun of the older one. So we're talking 18 is making fun of 22, because she uses outdated memes when she references things. And so already, that's a really short time period, but one is making fun of the other one because, you know, her slang is outdated, basically. So what do we do? What do we do with that when it's changing all the time and some people are saying this is the right way and that's the right way? What do we do with that? Well, the really good news is that we have a really good example in our Bible about what to do with that. If you have a Bible this morning, turn to Acts 17. We'll read from that in just a moment. It is written by a guy named Paul, if you're not familiar with it. And Paul was somebody who was a Jewish man that became a believer after Christ had died and was resurrected. And he had a very dramatic conversion to where he became a believer. And part of that conversion, he wanted to share Jesus with everybody. He wanted to make sure everybody knew who the Christ was. And he started with the Jewish believers. But then he was so passionate, he started to move out, and he took three or four missionary journeys, depending on how you kind of classify his last one. But he took these missionary journeys where he went from Jerusalem, okay, so like the hub of the Jewish culture, and he started going further and further out into the Greek culture, and ultimately he ended up in Rome. So you can see on this map here, the Mediterranean area, and, you know, starting in Jerusalem, but then he would... The first one is that white journey, which is kind of close to home, still kind of staying with a lot of the Jewish believers, but then, or the Jewish people, and then the blue and the yellow go further out, and then finally he found his way up to Rome, which, of course, the Greek culture in Rome was prevalent, and he found ways of engaging the culture that he was in. He didn't constantly, you know, like, just tell the Greeks, you're wrong, you should be Jewish, and then you got to become a believer, but he found ways to speak about who Jesus was to them. And so we can follow from his, or learn from his example. So chapter 17, it says, now when they had traveled through Amphipolis near Apollonia, I looked those up to make sure I could say them right, they came to Thessalonica, where there was a synagogue of the Jews. And according to Paul's custom, he visited them, and for three Sabbaths reasoned with them from the Scriptures, explaining and giving evidence that the Christ had to suffer and rise from the dead, and saying, "This Jesus who I am proclaiming to you is the Christ." So what he does is he goes to the Jewish synagogue first. And when he's at the synagogue, he speaks on three Sabbaths, so that's like three Sundays for us, you know, three church days to the church people. And while he's there, he speaks about Christ. So to the Jewish people, in a Jewish way, at a Jewish location, he uses words like Christ, which is something that they were familiar from their Old Testament, their only testament at the time. But they were looking for the Christ. And so this is all language and in a way and in a place that is very Jewish. And that's where he starts, and that's where he would speak to them. But we're going to jump now from that, where he would start like that, but now we jump to verse 16. And Paul is in Athens. Okay, he finds himself in Athens, which is a city. It's not in its cultural prime any longer. It used to be kind of a hub of Greek culture, but it has fallen into a little bit of disrepair. But it still has a university there, and so it's still a place. I imagine a lot of coffee shops with a lot of young people sitting around discussing like the universe and politics and that kind of thing. But this is a city where, you know, there's still a lot of intellectuals, and it's very Greek in its culture, obviously. So let's read this, if you would, with me. "Now, while Paul was waiting for them in Athens, his spirit was being provoked within him as he observed that the city was full of idols. So he was reasoning in the synagogue with the Jews and the God-fearing Gentiles and in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be present." So right away, you know, he would speak to the Jews, you know, to the people in church, but he would also go into the marketplace. And guess who was in the marketplace? You know, everyone. I mean, any and everyone was there. That was outside of the church, basically. And he would go and speak. "Now, some of the Epicurean and the Stoic philosophers as well were there, conversing with him. Some were saying, 'What could this scavenger of tidbits want to say?'" Early like that. Also, "idle babbler," wished to say. Others would say, "He seems to be a proclaimer of strange deities," because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection. "And they took him and brought him to the..." I said I looked these up. I shouldn't have. I got cocky. Areopagus, I think that's right, saying, "May we know what this new teaching is, which you are proclaiming. I'm stuttering. "For you are bringing some strange things to our ears, so we want to know what these things mean." Now all the Athenians and the strangers visiting there used to spend their time in nothing other than telling or hearing something new. So Paul stood in the midst of the Areopagus and said, "Men of Athens, I observe that you are religious in all aspects. For while I was passing through and examining the objects of your worship, I also found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' Therefore, what you worship in ignorance, this I proclaim to you. The God who made the world and all things in it, since he is the Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands. Nor is he served by human hands, as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all people life and breath and all things. And he made for one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation, that they would seek God, if perhaps they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and exist, as even some of your own poets have said, for we also are his children. Being then the children of God, we ought not to think that the divine nature is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and thought of man. Therefore, having overlooked the times of ignorance, God is now declaring to men that all people everywhere should repent. because he has fixed a day in which we will judge the world in righteousness through a man whom he has appointed, having furnished proof to all men by raising him from the dead. Now when they had heard the resurrection of the dead, some began to sneer, but others said, "We shall hear you again concerning this." So, big passage, and I don't necessarily want to really dive into the content of what he is saying as such, but listen to kind of some of the clues in what he was getting at. So, he goes to the place of Areopagus, which is the place that they would gather and they would discuss philosophies, and people would debate or argue and talk about the gods and the world and, again, politics and all of those things, and they would get discussed in this free forum where anybody could come and talk. And so when they heard him, they're like, this is new. You should come talk to where the cool kids are and come hang out with us and tell us what you're thinking. And so they invite him back. And if you notice, he doesn't use the word the Christ or the Messiah or even the name Jesus at that point, right? Instead, he talks about God and what God has done. He describes who Jesus is, risen from the dead. He talks about that, but he doesn't use the words that he would use if he was talking with somebody that was Jewish. You know, he knows who his audience is. So what does he do? So while Paul is in Athens, right, he wanders around, and it says that he observes what exactly is going on. And that's the first one of my points is, you know, he observes their culture. He sees what they're about, what's important to them, and he identifies their needs, right? So he sees, okay, look, they've got a lot of gods, a lot of altars to these gods here. And in that way, he's identifying, he's observing what's going on, and then he sees, wow, they have so many, they even have an unknown god, an altar to an unknown god. And he sees, okay, they need to know who God is. This unknown God that they talk about, they need to know him. So he looks at their culture, he sees what they need, and then he engages them when he talks to them. The things that he addresses, like he talks about how we get our being from God, that goes completely against what the Stoics, for example, that were there, it tells us they were there, what their belief system was. They believed that, you know, it's all about me and self-sufficiency and everything comes from me. And so when Paul's talking, he knows his audience and he makes sure that he addresses an issue that's going to be very specific to them. And so he, he very, very much explains, you guys think this, but I think this. And he doesn't do it in a way that's rude. He's not like calling them out, you Stoics? And he doesn't get like confrontational with them, but he does address what they believe because he knows who his audience is. And then he even gets to a point where he says, even your own poets say. And so it's like he knows enough about them and what they believe and what they think that he's able to use even their own writing to support what he's talking about when it comes to God. And beforehand with the elders, Pastor used a really good word. It's like he leveraged the culture and what they believed and what they thought to explain to them who Jesus was. And it's just a beautiful picture of how you can listen and observe and be slow to speak maybe, but then engage and engage in a meaningful way with people. So what does that translate to us today and how we interact? First, you know, we should look. It's that observe stage. Like he wandered around and he noticed the idols. Well, every generation has influences. These big things that affect how they think and how they live, how they spend their time, what they value. An example of that, if you're a baby boomer, you had television in the house, right? So television influenced the baby boomers the way computers did. For Gen X, myself, we had computers, and that was new. Millennials, it was the internet, which sometimes I forget that, like, even though I had computers at school, like, we didn't have the internet. And then the iPhone, of course, affects the Gen Z. who it's like breathing. It's oxygen to them. They have to have that iPhone with them. So it's like we have these things that affect us and start giving shape to, like, kind of in broad strokes, a shape of who the generation is. So some identifiable, every generation, in fact, has identifiable trends. And now there's outliers, of course, people who don't do these things. But a majority of people in this given age group will act this way. There's these guys, Howe and Strauss, and they are researchers on generations. They describe it's a peer personality, okay? So like a peer group and what they are like of a generation. It's a caricature, or it's a prototypical member. So, you know, kind of the average person of this age will be like ... And what that tells us, though, when you identify, okay, they are of this age, that means they probably think a certain way about things, because there are collective attitudes about family life, sex roles, institutions, politics, religion, lifestyle, and the future. And based on age, there are things that you can kind of safely assume about them. Again, it's not everybody, but it is a majority. So that's watching. And how do you learn that? Well, it's watching. You know, you can read a little bit about this generation or that generation, and it gives you an idea of who they are. So that would be the first thing, is observing. Or even you can just, what do they watch? What do they listen to? Where do they spend their money? Those are all clues into who people are or what they value. But then you can identify the need. Once you've done that, you kind of see who they are a little bit, you get to know them, then you identify the needs. The things that are going on around you as you grow up, they affect how you understand things. If you take family life as an example, now these are generalizations, but if you're a baby boomer, most likely your dad worked full-time and your mom stayed at home, most, not all. But that was kind of the traditional family that they grew up with. And then with Gen X, we were given the phrase latchkey kids. You guys remember that? Because we were given a key because both parents were working. That was really common for us. And then millennials, parents, we tended to be a little more involved, maybe to the point of hovering, I think. Maybe a little overprotective at times. And now millennials are having kids of their own. And I think we could say, the best we could probably say at this point, because we're still kind of feeling it out a little bit, but a lot of times they're really busy. They are doing a lot. Their kids are in a lot of sports, and there's a lot of extra things, and they are busy. So those are just some general ones that you could kind of identify. And it affects what they value. It affects how you see things, kind of a lens that you see things through. A little example. So pizza, youth ministry, pizza is kind of a staple of that. And when I was a student, just having pizza was enough, right? Just, you wanted to have enough pizza, but made sure there was pizza. That was good. We'd all eat it and we're all good. But then after that, like the students I was working with, you wanted to make sure you had a variety of pizza, right? Because like, oh, I don't like that kind. I don't like that kind. And maybe you'd throw in, you know, a tray of carrots or you know, vegetables or something like that, because there were a few kids who liked that. And now as you have these, the Gen Z, I'll be honest, it's a little, it can be overwhelming, but it's worth it. Now, you know, you have to have one that maybe is gluten-free because you have a lot of kids with allergies, of course. You got to have that pizza. You got to have a pizza that is a vegetarian option, because there are kids that are vegetarians. You want to make sure that you have maybe a keto-friendly pizza, right? So those are all like these options. And at first, you could almost want to just kind of laugh about it a little bit. I mean, I'd even say there was a point in time where it was safe. You know, vegans were kind of the safe, you know, people group that you could kind of joke about, right? But the truth is, like, you have students now that those are their values. They care about what they eat. That's just true. They do. And we didn't. Like, I was like, well, we didn't do that. And it would be easy to just kind of dismiss them. Like, just eat it. You're fine. But that attitude towards them can really, one can be a writ, like, dude, that church, those people there, they don't care about me. And I know it's something so simple as like having enough options of pizza, but it matters. You know, we do have a middle schooler, and she has to, and she's a gluten-free one, you know, she has an allergy to it. And there's been a few times when I haven't had something, and she's a little bit disappointed. But the times I have had something, she is so excited. And she's, oh, and she gets so excited that I thought of her. You know, and it's a little bit of effort, but it shows that you care about that person. And like I said, it's that changing of generations, and it's only, I mean, it's pizza, which sounds so crazy, but it can matter. And it takes observing, you know, watching and seeing what they value, what their needs are, and then meeting those. And even if it's something as simple as pizza like that. So as we seek to share Jesus with all these different groups, the aspect that stands out to them can be different. In relation to the baby boomers, the concept of a loving father can sometimes appeal because, like, their dads were a little bit disconnected because they were working all the time. You know, maybe you grew up with that, and so when you hear that, you know, that God is a loving father, you're like, yeah, that is what I need. That is great. Or Gen X, you know, we're left alone a lot. A lot of them experience divorce, so the church as a family is appealing. They realize, oh man, you know, I have a family at this that I didn't have, or I felt I was missing growing up. Millennials can find confidence in who God made them, maybe a purpose greater than themselves, because sometimes, you know, their parents were kind of a little bit sheltering for them. And so now they have, wow, this is exciting and new, and to find some confidence in who they are in Christ. And Gen Z, you know, social media is growing. They are growing up with that. It's been there since they've been born, most of them. And it's part of their life. But growing up with that being part of your life, like, there is a constant, if you put stuff out there, you're getting critiqued. But then if you look at somebody else's and you kind of judge yourself based on their, what you're seeing of them, you see a picture-perfect world, right? Like, Autumn, my daughter, likes to take photographs. And people are always like, man, Autumn, you're really good at those. And she's like, yeah, I took like 50 to get the one that you like. You know, I mean, so it's, she had 50 really bad pictures to get to the one that she put out there. And people think, oh, wow, you know, you're so good at this. It's like, well, you see that little bit of an image, right? And with social media, that's what they see. They see these perfect images of people that are set up, and they might have taken 50, you know, 50 other pictures before they got that perfect one. But you don't know that. When you're on this side of it, it feels like, wow, they're perfect. Or look at what they're doing. You know, you see them having these great adventures or something. And you can really be hard on yourself. And I think a lot of young people, they very much are that. So when they hear about a God who accepts them as their imperfect, flawed self, that's appealing. Like, oh yeah, that's something I want. You mean I can be accepted and not judged? Yeah. Okay, I'm on board. Like, that's something I want. So to each generation, we engage in that thinking that they're doing, just like Paul did, where he took what he knew that they thought, and he kind of turned it around and showed how Jesus was in these things. So to each generation, the good news of Jesus, it doesn't change who God is and who Jesus is. That doesn't change. You know, Paul didn't change any aspect of the truth when he got to the end. You know, he's like, it is about Christ. Well, he doesn't say Christ. It's about the resurrection, you know, and he doesn't change his message, but how he presents it. Do any of you have a favorite cup in the cupboard that you have all these cups, but you grab one that you like more than others? My house has a problem with cups. We each have like our own cupboard that has a plethora of cups that we get to choose from. But we all have our favorites, right? So like, even though I've got like 10 cups that are mine, if it's there and it's clean, and sometimes even if it's not clean, I'll find it. But it's I have a Spider-Man cup, and it's just a little bit bigger than the average coffee mug. It's just slightly bigger, but not as big as my Batman mug, because that's too big. And so I have to, like, two-hand that one. So the Spider-Man's just right, and it's Spider-Man. So it's like it's got two things about it that I really love that cup. And we all have that. We all have these cups that like, we'll reach for first. Now the cup can change. So, like, I grab mine, Ivy grabs hers, Autumn grabs hers, Cora grabs hers, Alicia grabs hers. So we all have different cups, right? Different sizes, shapes, whatever. But if I grab out the milk and I pour milk in all the cups, the milk doesn't change, right? So with God, how we present Jesus to people is kind of like that cup. And what we are presenting about him can kind of change what it looks like to them. But what's inside of it doesn't change. And, you know, we say Jesus is the living water, right? So it's that living water that's inside the cup that doesn't change. And that's really crucial. The message, the heart of what we are saying is always the same, but it's the cup that can change. I'm going to take this a little bit further because and it's not just the cup, but what's inside of it, not that it changes, but what we focus on, what appeals most to us can change a little bit. This is a new thought I had, and I really like Dutch Bros, like quite a bit. Particularly, I have discovered this candy cane mocha, which I don't like it all the time, but I really do like it around during the winter months and around Christmas and stuff. But so the candy cane mocha. Now, here's the thing. Candy cane mocha is a mocha, so it's got the chocolate part. It has the coffee part. It has the whipped cream part. And it has the sprinkles, the candy cane sprinkles, because, yeah, we'll get there. The candy cane sprinkles on top. And then the peppermint, the mint flavor that they put in it. So it's got all these different components that make up the candy cane mocha, right? And I like the drink, but if you leave out any part of that, I'm a little bit disappointed. It's like, oh, it's good, but it's not the same. It is all of it together. But the thing that you better not forget, well, I'm not threatening. The thing, though, that I really, really want to be there, I want to make sure is on there, it's actually the sprinkles, which is, like, really weird. But it is the sprinkles. And it's like, if you forget those, oh, it's good, but I'm disappointed. Because for whatever reason, that's the thing that makes the drink for me. Some people, it's going to be the whipped cream. Alicia, if she gets her drink and doesn't have the whipped cream, she'll drink it, but she's disappointed that little bit of whipped cream is not on the drink. I don't know why it changes it for her, but it does. And then in the same way, I wouldn't take any of those things separate. Like, I don't want just peppermint syrup to drink. Oh, that'd be horrible. But when you put it all together, it's the complete drink, right? Even though there's a part of it that I like the most. Now, where am I going with this overly complicated illustration? Is that with Christ, it's like that too. Okay, so there are these different aspects of God. It's God, right? And it's taken all together. But there are these little bits that to you as an individual matters most to you. And you're like, oh, that's the thing about Jesus that I like the most. And we all have different ones, different things about him that we really hone in on. You know, some of us really love that Jesus is the God of forgiveness, so he forgives us. We love that forgiveness part. Others, it might be that we embrace the forgiveness, but for some, it's how he's always with us, right? We're never left alone because Jesus is always right by us. It's great because I can see when I mention one of these, some people are like, oh, yeah. And it's like, you're the one that likes the peppermint sprinkles. See, you like that little bit. You love all of Jesus, but that aspect of him really resonates with you. You know, it might be the purpose or meaning, significance that we find in following Jesus. All the same Jesus, all different aspects of him, right? So with young people today, they are going to be significantly impacted by COVID. I mean, honestly, like we all are and will be. But them in particular, as they are growing up in it, the effects it will have on how they behave moving forward will probably be significant. Most likely, it'll have some sort of impact to them. And It might make them afraid of getting too close to people, like literally, physically, but also maybe emotionally. They don't want to get too close because, you know, they've had this year of, you know, distance. But they might actually react the opposite and be really close and really needing that and really craving that and going out of their way to get close with people. So we don't quite know yet what that's going to look like. To be honest, I've experienced a little bit more of that desire to get together, to be together, because it is missing in these other parts of their life. I had the students share today, to kind of highlight this. We're being told a lot about how young people are really struggling with this, and rates of depression are up, and I'm not discounting that because I believe it. I think that's really true, but on our end here at the church, like I've actually experienced the opposite. And if you listen, they've had some hard things in their lives, but overall they're like, no, I'm doing okay. It's all right. And I realized as I was talking to them, you know, the reason they're doing okay in a lot of ways, it's because they have a church family. They're coming to youth group, and they are connecting and being cared for here. And I think the students who don't have that, they don't have anything. We have a lot of, especially our middle school has really seen a lot of new faces. Both have, but especially in the middle school. This is a side note on that. This last week, we gave 9 Bibles to students that did not have them. And I was so excited by that. Isn't that neat? And so I gave them those and, you know, and said, here's a Bible for you. We want you. This is yours. Put your name in it. I want you to bring it back, though, so that we can teach you how to use it. And then students who've been coming for a long time and have their own Bibles are like, oh, should I bring mine? It's like, yeah, that would be great. Which I tell them every week when I'm speaking. I'm like, yeah, if you got a Bible, you know, you want to bring it. And I tell them every week. And then they're, oh, should I bring them my Bible? Yeah. That would be great. So anyway, that was a highlight. This is really exciting this last week. That we could do that. So I wanted them to share, though, because I see that they are actually kind of weathering this a little bit better. And why? Because they have a community. They are able to, you know, able to connect with people a little bit more. But then, you know, it hurts the heart because you know that there's a lot of people out there that don't have that yet. So how do we get them? How do we reach them? You know, it's really about observing what's going on, identifying their needs, and then engaging with them. And what we do with young people, what I've illustrated and highlighted them a lot, but the truth is it's not just young people that's what we should be doing it with. That's how we engage we should really engage everybody in our lives. Be slow to speak, right? Maybe observe them, see where they're at, and then identify what's going on in their life and what need do you need to speak to as you bring that gospel to them, the good news of who Jesus is and what he can do for them, and you want to share that with them, but before you just blast them with it, step back a second and see where they're at. See what's going on in their life. See how you can, you know, step in and basically be Jesus, be the gospel to them at that point. I have one more passage I want to look at. 1 Corinthians 9. 19 through 22. So this is Paul again. And something he says, for though I am free from all men, I have made myself a slave to all so that I may win more. To the Jews I become as a Jew so that I might win Jews. To those who are under the law, as under the law, though not being myself under the law, so that I might win those who are under the law. See, he recognizes that, you know what, there's more to this, sorry. He says, to the weak I become weak, to win the weak, I have become all things to all people, so that by all possible means I might save some. I do this for the sake of the gospel that I may share in its blessing. So what Paul says here in Corinthians, he says it doesn't matter really what you're identifying. You know, I'm this, I'm that, I'm the other. He's like, it's not about those things. You can become all things to all people that we can save some. You know, he's saying it's not about your personal, you know, this is right, this is wrong, this is who I am. It's finding a way to be what that person needs you to be. Never compromising on the gospel or on the word of God and who God is, but finding a way to be what that person needs you to be with God. You know, coming into their life, speaking into their life in such a way that their needs are met. Because that's what Jesus is about. You know, he's there and he loves us and he wants to meet them. So you find that way to enter into that with them. I have a paraphrase that I really like. And so it's the Message Bible. It's like I said, it is a paraphrase, but it says this so beautifully. It says, even though I am free of the demands and expectations of everyone, I have voluntarily become a servant to any and all in order to reach a wide range of people. Religious, non-religious, meticulous moralists, loose-living immoralists, the defeated, the demoralized, whoever. I didn't take on their way of life. That's so important. I didn't take on their way of life. I kept my bearings in Christ. But I entered their world and tried to experience things from their point of view. I become just about every sort of servant there is in my attempts to lead those I meet into a God-saved life. I did all of this because of the message. I didn't just want to talk about it. I wanted to be in on it. So I love that he says, you know, I didn't take on their way of life. I kept my bearings in Christ, but I entered into their world and tried to experience things from their point of view. Not just even understand or, oh yeah, that's too bad. He tried to experience what they experienced. Tried to relate to them at such a deep level that he understood what they were going through. It's exactly what we saw him do at the very beginning in Acts, you know, with the in Athens when he talked to those people. He understood them and he spoke truth into their lives after he became as much like them as he could without compromising who God was in him. So the idea of culture and generations that I've been talking about today, hopefully you'll leave, it has a bearing on things, but it's not the be-all, end-all. As Paul, we want to seek ways to become all things to all people so that we can save some of them. We've got a couple more songs right now, so you guys come on up. And I will move.